Всім добрий вечір. On behalf of the brave. On behalf of every father and every mother. Wings for freedom. They have our heroes. And paves the way for a new history.
Dobro večer, good evening, afternoon or morning, wherever you're tuning in from, and welcome to Tochni. On behalf of every father and every mother, of every defender of their skies, on behalf of their warriors, of Ukraine's people, on a week in which Ukraine's prominent losses of so many of its people, young and older, their futures snatched from them by Russia, the words of President Zelensky at Westminster Hall on the 8th of February this year, like so many of his speeches to electorates of Ukraine's allies across the world, resonate acutely this week. Words which, like the singing voices and music of Kristina Spitsina and Svetlana Simakina in Zaporizhia, the words, work and legacy of people like Denis Tarasov, a man cut down in his prime in the same city, these voices, their work and legacy, will endure. The deaths testament to the inadequacy of Ukraine's allies in governments around the world in providing Ukraine with enough weapons material to protect its heroes of today and its future of tomorrow. Testament to the resolve yet to be adequately delivered by Ukraine's Western allies, that we should not wait to strike till the iron is hot, but make it hot by striking. At Tochni, we try to bring you the stories behind the headlines. Today, we are privileged to be joined by one man who has been on the ground in Ukraine, supporting Ukrainians in ways which have saved Ukrainian lives. Tochni's own Joseph Thompson will be interviewing James Spensley about his extraordinary work. Tochni is a podcast, of course, on Spotify, Apple, and a plethora of other platforms. The broadcast's live as a Twitter space. Please follow our main account on Twitter if you're listening on one of these podcast platforms for notifications about upcoming broadcasts such as this one. Our podcast series, Tochni Talks, which has, of course, featured guests like Michael Weiss, Dr. Ian Garner, and Dr. Mara Gili, also has a very special upcoming interview tomorrow, Monday, August the 14th, with the Halo Trust. This unique interview will happen here at 1700 Kyiv tomorrow. That's 1400 UTC or 0900 Eastern Time. It is therefore a privilege to be joined today by James Spensley, one of the people who has been on the ground in Ukraine assisting its people. So over to you, Joseph.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And Jonathan mentioned, very pleased to introduce our guest today. James Spensley is the founder and former CEO of a major telecommunications company in Australia called Vocus Communications. In 2021, he was also elected as a councillor for St. Leonard's Ward of North Sydney Council in Australia as an independent. James lived in Ukraine from 2003 to 2006 and is the organizer of AUS Ukraine Aid, an effort to source and supply ambulances to Ukraine. Up to this point, AUS or AUS Ukraine Aid has delivered 46 ambulances and will deliver 7 more in the next few weeks. So, James, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And so from the introduction, I think it's pretty clear you wear a lot of hats and you're a pretty busy guy, James. So I'm very curious, I think maybe our audience is like, how did this come about that you started sending ambulances directly to Ukraine and not just delivering them to Kyiv, but very, very close to like where they're needed? How did you come about doing
this? Yeah, look, as you mentioned, I lived in Ukraine for about three and a half years. Met my wife there, so my wife's Ukrainian, my kids are half Ukrainian. So once we saw the invasion, you know, we knew we wanted to do something. We wanted to help. And it was just so hard back probably, you know, was it 18 months ago almost now, to actually find a way to help Ukraine. You know, you could donate to UNICEF or Red Cross or any of these big organizations, but there was absolutely no guarantee or likelihood even that donation would, you know, make it into Ukraine and find a home and do good. So my wife and I just sort of were Googling around about how, you know, how we could help Ukraine. And we saw an article about how ambulances were being destroyed, how, you know, at the time that they need the most amount of ambulances obviously they had the least because they were being blown up at the front lines or in the cities and in the battles. So we bought one ambulance each, so second hand from France. I flew over, picked the ambulances up, drove them to Poland, and then we drove them into Ukraine. And our purpose was to really make sure that they found a home. You know, it's like with donating to UNICEF or these big organizations. You know, you want to make sure that it actually, you know, the donation's important, but making sure it actually gets to the people who need it and need it the most is the most important part. So that's why we always hand deliver our vehicles. We did it on the first time. And, I think I remember on that first trip, I met a soldier and he was about my age and had kids my age. And we got talking and I said, oh, you know, you've been in the army a long time. And he said, oh, no, I just joined up on February, 25th. I drove my kids and wife to Lviv and then came back and joined the army. And I said, how do you kind of get that concept in your head? You know, you have no experience. You're in Kyiv. They give you a gun. You're fighting the next day. You know, you're most likely to die of everyone. You have no experience. How do you justify that when you've got kids? And he said one thing that really moved me and you know, made me realize that I've got to keep helping Ukraine. And what he said to me was, the only thing I value more than seeing my kids grow up is knowing that my kids will grow up free. And that's when I knew I had to keep helping and doing what we could to bring more guys like that home to their families.
Yeah, definitely. And I noticed on your Twitter account, you you do some fundraising, obviously, for, you call it Aus Ukraine or AUS Ukraine?
Yeah, Aus Ukraine. That's right. Yeah.
Aus Ukraine. Okay, got it. So Aus Ukraine, you do obviously fundraising for Aus Ukraine, but you match a lot of donations. Like a lot of people donate and you say, oh, cool, so-and-so donated. I'm going to match that. But so I'm just curious, where do you get the bulk of your funding and how do you go about? Because not only do you, you know, acquire these ambulances, but you're filling them with medical equipment. You're also, you have to tune them up and stuff. You need gas to get to the country. All that stuff's expensive. So where's the funding come from?
Yeah, look, mostly it comes from donations. I'm pretty well connected in Australia, so I'm able to go around to sort of businesses and people I know and get donations there. It was certainly a lot easier, 18 months ago, of course, and 12 months ago. It's much, much harder now. You know, I put a call out on Twitter, for example, for donations, and I might get $500 or $1,000, which is fantastic. But, our convoys cost upwards of $100,000 per sort of group of six or seven ambulances with all the medical supplies in them. So, I end up funding a bit of it myself. I always joke that it's the only time you can fund something, donate and 110-120% of what you donate goes to the cause, because I cover all the transport, all the volunteer expenses, all the petrol, all that sort of stuff. So you actually do, when you donate to the GoFundMe or my PayPal, you actually, 100% goes to funding an ambulance and supporting it. And I think it's, as a business person, I always look at, return on investment. And I think for, $15,000 or $20,000 that we build these vehicles, and they may save at least a couple of lives a week, while they're in use. They're right on the front lines. They're taking people from where they're wounded to where they can get better medical help. And I think that's, for saving at least two or three lives a week, that's an incredible investment.
I'm inclined to agree. It seems like a very sound investment to me as well. So I noticed on a lot of your photographs, there's like a team of people working with you. And so I'm just curious about the team. It looks like a lot of them go into Ukraine with you. And, it's probably not an easy job. It requires a lot of, understanding the situation. Because, again, you guys are going up to areas that are a lot more dangerous than just, like going to Kyiv or something. So, if you could maybe tell us a little bit more about the team you work with.
Yeah, it's mostly Polish guys. We've had, it started out with, I had one guy I met in Poland and he came with me, and then, his friend and a couple of their friends. And, we got some guys who are into cars who helped us, refit, modify the vehicles, the custom evacuation vehicles, we call them now. And so we've got a team of probably about 20, at least sort of 10 or 12 in Poland who go out and find the vehicle we need, inspect them, deliver them to the mechanics, do some of the work on the vehicle. We had one guy, he paints the vehicles for us. A lot of the mechanics work, give us out their hours for free. And then we've got about 8 to 10 guys that come with us on the trips. and then we basically just drive a vehicle each. We do it in a convoy, so we all sort of depart together, and we do a big loop of Ukraine. We typically, on average, do about 2,500 kilometers inside Ukraine driving these vehicles. So I think all up, I've driven maybe 22,000 kilometers in Ukraine since the war started, and if you add up all of the vehicles, it's some crazy number, like, I don't know, it's like 250,000 to 500,000 kilometers or something that's been delivering these vehicles. It's like 20 times around the world or something. So it's good having a team. We always keep our focus on our goal, you know, avoid any politics, just keep our head down. We don't get involved in Twitter wars. We always, really support each other. And I think that's helped a lot. And I call it our North Star. You know, we have our North Star, which is that we are doing what we're doing to bring more soldiers home to their families. And when somebody has an issue with somebody else, or, you know, days don't go as we planned, we're broken down on the side of the road, whatever, everyone's stressed, you know, and someone starts getting, annoyed or whatever, we just say, you know, why are we here, guys? We're here to bring more people home to, you know, more soldiers home to their families. And it puts it into perspective. So I think, you know, where I've seen a lot of volunteer groups sort of fall apart or have disputes or splinter off into different, you know, groups, we've stayed together and really, really tight, which is awesome.
Yeah, you can kind of tell from the photos, you guys seem to get along really well. I mentioned before that you guys stock the ambulances with supplies, I assume medical equipment and maybe some medicine. I'm just curious what the process for that is, how you kind of source the stuff, how you decide what is necessary, what goes in an ambulance, and if there's any maybe issues with moving medical equipment across the border and so forth.
Well, we've stayed away from medicines for that reason. It just gets really complicated. So we do typically, you know, really, really simple supplies. So, gauze, combat tourniquets. We buy those mostly in Ukraine now. Bandages, Israeli bandages, things that they go through a lot of. And we just, we fill in the vehicle with as much of those as we can. We always try and find ways to get it cheaper and make sure the quality's there. So we sometimes get, we get like a couple of pallets of the from China. We then, give it to the guys, get them to test, make sure it's up to standard, and then we know we can buy those again and keep shipping them through. So yeah, other things, we also take a lot of food now. We went into Kherson just after, probably like 5 weeks after it was liberated. We went to some of the towns that are close to the Dnipro that were, quite far away from Kherson city, and we actually, we just bought them food, just stopped by the side of the road when we saw a village and gave them a bunch of food, and the next village heard we were coming and had everyone lined up. And yeah, we just try and make the best use of the time that we're there. It's pretty easy to fill, buy bulk food in Poland and then deliver it on the way.
Yeah, it's definitely something we hear from volunteers that, people want, like, they're loading their car up with everything they can manage or whatever vehicles they have to get stuff to Ukraine. So I'm curious, in terms of obviously the vehicles are being used. They're being used in combat zones, I assume, or at least, or I shouldn't say at least, but some of them are being used in combat zones, and some of them, I assume, are being used maybe in areas with shelling and so forth. So I assume there's got to be some feedback in terms of how people are using the vehicles, and maybe some stuff that you're incorporating, because you've done several trips at this point. Are there any kind of improvements you're making or changes, help medics, or based on the feedback they're giving you?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the other advantages of actually delivering them, meeting the medics. We get the feedback. So the first few trips we took ambulances, regular city-sized ambulances with, heavy stretchers in the back and, really low clearance, and they're designed for city roads. And, we met a lot of people along the way who were delivering the same things. And, of course, soldiers in the front lines, they'll take whatever you get. And they'll be thankful. And when you actually go and meet them and you deliver the ambulance, they're like, fantastic, thank you. And then they go and inspect the stretcher, and they're like, ah, it's got a really heavy stretcher. I'm like, well, why does that matter? And you go, oh, well, this ambulance, you know, it's not off-road, so we can't get to where the wounded are. Wounded don't get wounded on roads. They get wounded, you know, out in the middle of fields, you know, where there's artillery and potholes and mud. And we need, you know, we need to carry the guy, the wounded person, you know, sometimes, you know, a kilometer or two to the road. And I'm thinking, this is crazy, right? You know, why don't we give you something that's four-wheel drive, you know? Why don't we, you know, do you need all the equipment in the ambulance? No, you know, the main point that most of the vehicles we've given are their evacuation vehicles. So they take the soldier from the point of being wounded to, you know, to a stabilization point. So that's where there's, you know, not just a combat medic, but a combat doctor. And then that's where they stabilize the patient. And then a city ambulance comes and picks them up and takes them, you know, to a more regular hospital or an army hospital. And so this is where we found the biggest need. You know, we saw there's lots and lots of ambulances, regular ambulances going from the stabilization point to the hospitals. But the guys were, and we saw one wounded guy come in on the back of a pickup truck. Literally, that's what they used to transport their wounded was they put him on the back of an open to the elements pickup truck and drove him to the stabilization point. So, you know, the couple of problems with that is winter, you know, it's freezing cold. Two, your medic can't work on the person, you know, stop blood loss, you know, comfort them, all of those things, you know, when they're in the front of the cab and the wounded person's in the, you know, in the back. So, yeah, we kind of, by seeing what they actually do and how they work and what, you know, the real war situation is like, we customized and we talked with them about the type of stretcher they wanted, how they wanted it to go into the vehicle, you know, did it lock in place, did it have legs that fold down? And what they actually wanted was really simple stretchers, the same ones that helicopters use. They're called basket stretchers. They're very light. You know, they're about, yeah, probably 10 centimeters, so about 4 inches high, lots of hold points to lift the person. And then we built a frame around those to be able to slide them into the four-wheel drive and then, you know, took a bunch of the seats out so that it could do it. Delivered one of them as a prototype, and, you know, the medic loved it, thought it was fantastic, and we've just been evolving them ever since. So, yeah, it's absolutely a case of unless, you know, I mean, nobody knows now, you know, really from the Western world, you know, the inside details of how war works and how, you know, people operate. And the West give lots of guns and lots of ammunition and, you know, not enough, clearly. But, you know, there's not a lot of thought going into, you know, keeping the soldiers alive. So, yeah, we've tried to do our best and build what they need for the lowest possible price so we can do lots of them.
Got it. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you've sort of designed a different sort of, you know, ambulance vehicle that is lighter, it's maybe a little bit more efficient, and it's based around the fact that because Ukrainians have kind of a medical system that is being, you know, it's not like some of the expeditionary wars we've seen in the past where you got to treat someone, you know, pretty thoroughly, like on site, right? It's about getting them quickly, you know, to another site where another team can work. So as you said, you've got a, you know, four-wheel drive, quick, you know, easy loading and unloading and things like that. So did I kind of understand that correctly? Yeah, exactly. Or did you maybe want to
correct exactly that? I mean, look, the combat medics will work on the person and stop bleeding and basically stabilize the patient. But, you know, then they're not in a position to, you know, operate or remove shrapnel or do anything, you know, more complicated. Their job is literally just to stop the bleeding and then get the person back to a stabilization point as quickly as possible. You know, the vehicles we do, we give them, you know, mud tires or all-terrain tires. We raise the suspension, you know, up to, in Nissan Pathfinders, we raise them about 30 centimeters. So they've got massive clearance so they can go over all the craters and potholes and the like in the fields and get them in and out fast. So that's the point is, you know, the Russians will target ambulances. They'll target medical officers more so than any other soldiers. And the need is to get them in and out as quickly as possible. So a nice, fast four-wheel drive with raised suspension, big old mud tires, you know, is basically the dream vehicle for these guys. And that's what we've been building.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I guess I'm curious about the process of how the ambulances actually make it from wherever the origin point is directly to the guys on the front lines who need them. So if you can maybe just describe like a journey from A to B, how do the ambulances get delivered?
Yeah, look, I mean, they start their life in, you know, Germany or Poland or the UK even, and we get a volunteer to drive them to the warehouse in Poland, and then we drive them across the border. We go on a big route, so we just drop them off on the way. Typically, we've been dropping, you know, earlier in the conflict, we've been dropping to areas like Nikolaev when that was Yeah, that was kind of a front line there. We've done a lot to Zaporozhye, to just under Bakhmut, to Chasiv Yar and Konstantinivka, Kupiansk and Slovyansk. So you kind of got this big circle route, you know, from entering Ukraine in the west. We go south, east, you know, up to the north to Kharkiv and then back around. It's kind of the route that they take. We tend to do about 500 to 600 kilometers a day. That sort of slows down as you get closer to the east and to the active fighting areas. There's more checkpoints, and they call block posts. It gets a little bit harder to get through. You know, there's more checks, vehicle searches, things like that. So that tends to slow things down. You know, we get punctures on tire punctures, or, you know, cars break down, or, you know, a clutch goes. One of the things we do now is we routinely just replace the clutches on the vehicles because, you know, every 7 or 8 vehicles we take, one clutch goes. So now we just replace them so we don't have that problem. But we tend to break down quite a lot, you know, in the early days anyway. And it's quite a planned route. You know, we then typically meet the medical officers or the logistics guys we work with, you know, at a nondescript point, and then they'll take us to you know, to their base or to where the medical team are, and we deliver the vehicle and move on to the, you know, to the next city.
Yeah, thanks. And I think Ben might have a question about this. Ben, go ahead.
Thank you, Joseph. Good day, James. Thank you very much for everything you're doing. I have a question because I found myself a little bit in the same sort of situation, except with a lot of zeros less than you. But I'm always thinking, how am I deciding where I'm giving putting my money? Do I give $10 to that drone operation or to that ambulance, and then so-and-so needs... So anyway, what I wanted to know is how do you know to whom to give those ambulances to? And also, how do you coordinate your work with maybe the army? Is it the army? Yeah. How do you do you have contact? Do they tell you, oh, this and this brigade needs something, or is it...
Yeah, it's a really good question. Yeah, look, I mean, you know, every $10 counts, and that's the amazing thing. It's getting harder and harder to raise. And we focused on ambulances because they, you know, they directly save lives. And that was kind of our mission, was to get more people home to their families. But yeah, we typically find, you know, we'll deliver an ambulance. The guys will tell us about a different brigade operating in the area, or we'll stop at a petrol station literally, and, you know, some guys will come up to us and talk to us, and, you know, we drive off and, you know, have a chat to their commander, you know, have a chat to the you know, the colonel in charge of logistics. So we make sure that we triple check, you know, all of the requirements. Now that we've delivered enough, you know, we've got a long list. You know, we've got probably 20 after this 7, we've got another 20 that have got requests. We made a couple of early errors where we delivered it to quite small units within, like we deliver it to an artillery unit of 200 guys. You know, they have their own medical team, you know, medical officer, and that was kind of a learning point for us, was making sure we got it to somebody who was going to use it every day, you know, not somebody who was going to use it once a week. So that it got the most use. And I keep saying this to people, is aid is fantastic, but getting the aid to the person who needs it the absolute most and will use it the most is the thing that really delivers value. You know, it really makes a difference. So yeah, we have lots of great contacts in the army now, with lots of great contacts in the medical teams within all of the big brigades. This trip we're focusing on most of the units that are involved or most of the brigades that are involved in the counteroffensive. So we're actually, you know, we've been asked to build them larger four-wheel drive vehicles. So there's a couple of, on my Twitter, I've posted a couple of photos of the vehicles we've built. So they're old ex-Polish army vehicles. We've refurbished them, put 4 stretchers in there so we can transport, or they can transport, you know, more people at a time. So yeah, constantly adapting and also constantly just making new contacts and learning more. But it's the primary focus is always to be the most effective with the money that, you know, that we're given, so that it makes the biggest difference.
Thank you, Ben. James, I'm curious. I mean, it is a war zone. I've seen on your Twitter feed that occasionally, you know, things don't always go exactly according to plan. So, I mean, are there any stories about things that might have happened on trips to dangerous areas that might be worth telling to our audience?
Yeah, I mean, touch wood, we've survived so far. But we've had some close calls. We had an ambulance breakdown on the way to, actually on the way east to Bakhmut. A lot before Bakhmut was super super hot area. We were delivering it actually just slightly outside of there to Chasiv Yar, and Clutch goes in the ambulance. So we pull over onto the side of the road, and there's a little, you know, farmer's kind of track going down the off the main road, and we pull in, we stop, you know, we're kind of parking four or five vehicles at that point on this little track of road, and you know, the guys are mucking around while we're trying to find a mechanic to come and arrange to pick it up. And somebody just notices that there's a mine sign, you know, in the sunflower field on the right. And then someone notices there's one straight in front of us, and there's one on the left of us. So basically, you know, we've just parked all our vehicles on a tiny little piece of road surrounded by mine fields. So we all sort of hop back in the vehicle and call the mechanic and get him to come out and tow the vehicle very gently and carefully off the road. So yeah, there's just, it's a war zone. So there's, you know, there's constantly, you know, you'll wake up to artillery in the night in your hotel. You know, I got great stories from talking to the people in the hotels and over the time. And I remember one really stuck in my mind when I asked the hotel where the bomb shelter was. And she said, I was just, you know, it's the car park downstairs. And then I said to her, you know, what, you know, when the air raid siren goes off, do you go down there? She goes, nah, stopped doing that a long time ago. Better to die, you know, better to die in my own bed than to live in a bomb shelter. So there's always some really interesting anecdotes that kind of share the spirit of people on the ground at any point. We've had rockets land, one unexploded, actually, amazingly, across the road from our hotel. We've had the windows blown out of hotels. I mean, there's the odd occurrence of something that's dangerous, but we tend to try and stay, you know, if we sleep somewhere, we try and stay outside of artillery range, and we only do the deliveries, you know, where we go, you know, a few kilometers from the front lines and then get back up. Pretty quick, but yeah, nothing's safe, you know, nowhere safe with the amount of rockets and the like. And the worst things usually is, you know, back when Russia was targeting the power, and, you know, we'd be checking into the hotel and the power would go out, and the lady had just given, you know, me the key to the hotel, and it was on level 7 and the power goes out, and so you walk up the stairs for 7 floors. But that's, you know, minor inconveniences in the scheme of things. But probably the most interesting time was I had a meeting in Nikolaev with the governor, who's an awesome guy, Kim, down there. And I was running late, so I took off. We had a couple of the ambulances that were slow, and I was in a four-wheel drive that was fast. So we filled up my car back when fuel was really hard. You know, you couldn't get fuel in fuel stations, so we had a can. We filled up my car, and my main sort of volunteer, Conrad, took his passport and wallet out and put it on my car, and then just forgot about it. So I drove off. You know, there's no cell coverage, and I get to a checkpoint, and they, you know, they start, you know, asking me questions and searching the vehicle, and they find his wallet and his passport, and they go, "Who's this guy, Conrad?" And I'm thinking, "Oh God, he's going to be here soon." Anyway, so they hear chatter over the radio about a Polish guy at a different checkpoint. He'd taken the wrong turn and without any documents. So he was he pulled up to a checkpoint in the middle of a war. You know, this is Nikolaev, so it's probably was just outside of Nikolaev, so 40 k's from the front lines without any documents. And yeah, it was causing quite a stir. So now we tend to try and be a little bit more military in our way of thinking and checking things, and, you know, make sure everyone's got documents, everyone's got passports, everyone's got a radio, you know, so we can talk even if there's no cell coverage. Yeah, we're constantly learning and getting better. But it's been some hairy and then also some amusing moments along the way.
Yeah, it sounds, I don't know, it's not a typical situation that people find themselves dealing with, or not typical obstacles that most people face, but it's great to hear that everyone's so far been safe, and you guys seem to be doing it responsibly as one can, and you know, we wish you the most safety in your endeavors. Jonathan has a question. Jonathan, go ahead.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you, James, for everything you and your charity are doing. So I'm just wondering how you and your team, when you are delivering ambulances to these areas in which people are in critical need of them, and you come across these challenges, this minefield that you referenced earlier, you guys are completely on your own. How do you, you know, what kind of procedures do you try to follow when you come across that, you know, breakdown such as this?
Yeah, we're just getting better. You know, we now try to think like military people. You know, you don't move without your radio. You know, when you go to bed at night, you put your passport, your keys to the car, the radio next to your bed. So, you know, if something happens in the middle of the night, you know, power's out, who knows what goes on, you know, bomb hits, you can grab your, you know, your passport or your, at least your radio, and then we can all communicate, you know, things like that. So we started to try and be a lot more military-like in it and more structured. And that's actually quite hard because working with volunteers, they're not employees. So you can't say, hey, you have to do this. You know, you've kind of got to bring them on the journey and go, this is why we do this. It's because if this happens, you know, so you need to charge your radio. If you turn up in the morning with an uncharged radio, you're not just putting yourself at risk, you're putting everyone at risk. So it's kind of, it's people management on a different sort of style than I'm used to. But, you know, that's the great thing about working with the same guys every time. You know, they're getting better, I'm getting better, we're learning. And when things go wrong, you know, we deal with it. You know, we've left cars by the side of the road and continued on and then come back and got them, you know, after we've made our deliveries for the next few days. Otherwise, we'd, you know, breaking the, we'd have to move every meeting and, you know, we'd want to pull medics off, you know, multiple days to come and, you know, get ambulances from us when they've got lives to save. Luckily, I speak, you know, fairly decent Russian, which, you know, is still in the East, very well understood. So, you know, we can get a tow truck, we can get a mechanic. You know, if you're in need, though, one of the great things is, you know, people are just shocked to find, you know, a couple of Polish guys and an Australian guy. And, you know, we're, you know, in towns that are, you know, most of the locals have left and they're very, you know, willing to help us and, you know, very surprised to see us there. In fact, one of the nice anecdotes is almost every time we deliver an ambulance or, you know, meet a commander, you know, or a medic, the thing they say is the ambulance is going to save lives and we desperately need it. But the thing that means the most is that people from all around the world have donated to you, that you guys are here and you're helping us directly and you're not shying away from, you know, from supporting us. And they really feel, they know that the world supports them, you know, and definitely not enough, but they really feel that support when there's donations that have come from, you know, all around the world, deliver them something to help save their soldiers' lives. So, yeah, I think, look, how you deal with different situations, we deal with it. You know, the necessity is the mother of all invention, and being in a war zone is the mother of all necessity. So we beg by the side of the road if we, you know, if our vehicle's broken down, and you know, which we've had, our last vehicle's broken down, and so we've just waved people down. And I think the great thing about the only thing that's not a great thing, but the only positive thing that comes from war is that the country comes together in a way that I've never seen anything in my life. You know, the people help each other. You know, it's amazing to see, and that camaraderie extends greatly, and the help that we get from the locals is if we're in need is extraordinary.
It seems like in that type of situation, one has to become practical and adaptable pretty quickly, or you're not going to make it very far, I would imagine. So you know, kudos to you guys for
the other thing is it's really important to read the manual. We had a Peugeot ambulance, and we were driving along this bumpy road out in and we hit just this pothole in the ambulance and it just stopped working straight away. And we're thinking, you know, it's something complicated and none of us are mechanics, but we've got all the tools. As I say, we're starting to get more prepared. So now we have a full body of tools and we're by the side of the road, miles from anywhere. And we just break out the owner's manual in the glove box and, you know, going through it. And one of the things that says, if your vehicle randomly stops, please check the impact isolation for the fuel. And we're like, okay, where's that? And we look at the manual and take it down. And there's a little switch there. And basically it's an impact sensor. So that if you have an impact, it cuts the fuel off to the engine. And that had gone off and we pushed it back in and, you know, it started the vehicle up and drove off. And it was just one of those things, like, you know, sometimes you just got to read the manual.
Yeah, it makes sense. I never would have guessed that. So we have two questions. We got Bianade, then Ben. Bianade, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. James, you mentioned you're maintaining cars pretty well because, like, on the way, sometimes they break down. You described how it is in Ukraine and around Ukraine. Did you, because I often heard about this, volunteers break down on the road and then there's more or less really pretty fast Ukrainian and European support on this network where people can help each other. Have you ever witnessed something like this where you broke down in Europe and out of nowhere a contact said, like, oh, I know someone?
Look, it certainly happened in Ukraine. I've never, you know, driven in Europe and broken down in general Europe, but in Ukraine we've had you know, we've had people stop on the side of the road, and, you know, we haven't had cell phone coverage, and they've driven into town, picked up the local mechanic, brought him back. You know, he's taken a look at it. You know, he's arranged the local tow truck to come pick it up. And it's, you know, the support is incredible. One of the funny things is, we called up a tow truck, and he said, you know, when my terribly accented Russian, I asked how much for the tow truck, and he quoted me some ridiculous price. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. Anyway, he turns up and he goes, oh, you guys are volunteering here, you're helping. He's like, oh, I'll do it for this price. And it was something like 80% discount. And then, you know, I was sitting in the tow truck with him driving back to the town, and he goes, hey, you guys are great. Like, I'll do it for half the price that I already quoted you. So it was, yeah, that was like a 90% discount. And then by the time we actually got to the mechanic and we started to hand over the money and say, you know, what's the final price? He's like, actually, you know what? I'm not even going to take any money. So there's a great deal of goodwill and assistance we get. Yeah.
That's a great story. Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, those are great stories. I'm sorry, I've got a bit of a not so fun question to ask regarding the needs. You said that you gave one of the ambulances to an artillery unit and it was too small. On average, how many ambulances are needed per battalion? I guess that would be the relevant unit. And how many does that make for the whole Ukrainian army?
Great question, actually. And we went down this to try and understand and fit the right ambulances to the right sized units. So a battalion is somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people, can be a bit less, maybe 800. It's in that sort of realm. They typically like to have three evacuation vehicles or ambulances. Mostly they have one, maybe they have two at best. The ambulances are very heavily targeted by the Russians. So we used to turn up with Red Cross stuff on all the vehicles, and, you know, so that, you know, we were thinking, hey, don't shell us, you know, Russians, don't attack us. And the medic just kind of like walked up to us and ripped the Red Cross off the side of the vehicle and said, don't ever put Red Crosses on them. They're just targets to Russians. So, yeah, we learned pretty quick. But, yeah, back to the question. Yeah, they typically like to have three vehicles per 1,000, 1,500 soldiers. So take your number of soldiers, you know, actively fighting. If it's 500,000, then there's, what is it, do the maths, 3 per 1,000, so there's probably, what, 1,500 needed. And, you know, many of the battalions we work with, their version of an ambulance, as I said, is a pickup truck where they throw the guy in the back because the ambulance is long ago broken down or, you know, been blown up or something along those lines. So if you talk about the general need, I would say, we haven't found, when we've met, you know, a battalion or a brigade, one that has the three ambulances. You know, they started with three ambulances 18 months ago. We haven't met one that has them. And we typically try and find people who have none or one. And we've now started dealing actually at the brigade level. So brigades, most of the brigades are around 5,000 to 7,000 people. That's typically what we've seen. And then there's a brigade medical or chief medical officer for the brigade. So we deal with him, and then he knows which of his battalions needs the ambulance the most. And then, you know, he puts us in contact with the commander or deputy commander of the battalion, who then introduces us to the medical team. Then we work out what they need exactly. Is it four stretchers, one stretcher? Is it a regular ambulance? Is it off road? Then we put them on a list and try and deliver that in under sort of 8 weeks.
Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, thanks for the answer. I guess I have a follow-up question, which is that, beside the type of ambulance that and the fact that you're getting better at providing them and designing them, I guess, because you're doing some redesigning, have you seen an evolution in the need of the Ukrainian army regarding, well, this sector of operation? Are they starting to build, I don't know, field hospitals, if that's a thing? Are their need evolving? And as a consequence, are you preparing yourself to branch out into something else?
I think the problem with frontline ambulances is it's always a constant need because they, you know, they might last a week, they might last a year, but they don't last forever. So there is a constant need. So we're sticking pretty close and pretty true to, you know, what we know. I think we're the best at doing it of people who are doing it. So, you know, if we go and do something else, we may not be as good at that. We did defibrillators for a long while, mobile defibrillators. So we brought those in and gave those to field hospitals so that they could give them to medical unit which seemed to work very well, and we got feedback that saved a lot of lives. But to put it in perspective, we deliver an evacuation vehicle, and we can often get a phone call literally 2 hours, 3 hours after we've left, and the medical officer will go, "Oh, your vehicle was just used and literally just saved someone's life. If we didn't have that vehicle, they would have died." So we don't see a need to kind of live outside of doing what we do. We are also getting more cost-effective at doing it. You know, in the old days, we'd buy an ambulance which didn't get off-road, that didn't reach the wounded person, which wasn't exactly what they needed, but might cost us 15,000 euros. Now we're building these custom vehicles that's exactly what they want, that's got all of the proactive, you know, the clutches changed, the alternators, the batteries, the tires. We give them spare tires. We give them roof racks. We give them fire extinguishers. We give them spare fuses. We give them an extra stretcher. You know, we put all of this stuff in there, and it's costing us, you know, at least 5,000 cheaper than buying the regular old beaten up ambulances that we were buying. So yeah, we think we've got pretty good at it. So yeah, we'll keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, makes sense to me. Jacoby has a question. Go ahead, Jacoby.
Hi, thank you very much for taking a question from me, James. It's really interesting to hear how you and your comrades and colleagues have adapted, and it seems like it's an ever-evolving adaptation, you know, of equipment and vehicles on your part. And I just shared with you, and I didn't want to presume to share to the nest. I'd be happy to do so. This equipment that comes from a Canadian company, that it's a mobile, portable life support system. And I wonder if you have encountered these systems in your travels in Ukraine, if you've found them effective, in particularly given that you have to adapt. It sounds like you have to adapt everyday vehicles a lot of times to function as ambulances, you know, when ambulances are no longer available, even though they've been perhaps well outfitted and provided by organizations, you know, previous to this, and now you just have to work with what you have. I've understood these life support systems, they're portable in the size, they're about the size of a golf bag, can be very handy. But, you know, I'm wondering if they are as practical as they appear from your experience, or you haven't had an opportunity to encounter them.
I haven't encountered them, but, you know, we've encountered mobile, you know, like sonogram machines that can, you know, you hook it up to your iPhone and you can actually do like I mean, they're proper medical pieces of equipment, but you can do a mobile and find shrapnel in, you know, in a soldier's body and those types of things. So everything, literally everything is needed and everything is useful. The trick is about getting it in the right hands, because, you know, you give a piece of life-saving equipment like that to combat medic who basically is a really good, really experienced nurse, they're not going to know how to use it. So that's, that type of equipment is probably more suited to the stabilization point where the doctors actually work. The stabilization points are not glorious. They're usually just a house in a village that's quite close to the front line, you know, and that's where they treat the wounded, you know, it's sort of a central point where the doctors can work from. So that's probably more useful for those types of situations. So yeah, they can pick up and move house, you know, which they do quite, you know, move around so that they don't get targeted artillery, so they could pick their equipment up and move it around. So I would never say that anything related to medical support is not needed in Ukraine. Everything is needed, you know, from, you know, bandages to mobile life support systems. Absolutely everything is needed on a scale that's just not comprehensible. They don't get a lot of support. You know, they'll get artillery, they'll get you know, all sorts of weapon support, but it doesn't seem like any government anywhere that I've seen is focusing on giving medical aid to directly to these units who need it. It's astounding that they can be there and ask us if we've got any spare bandages, because they've run out of bandages, you know, for the whole battalion. That's the kind of thing that we, you know, we really, really focus on. So I think, yeah, definitely in use and need. And you know, if there was someone willing to donate them, I could definitely find the right people for it to go to.
Yeah, I mean, even tourniquets are still desperately needed in Ukraine, and they're still actively saving lives. It's, I mean, one of the smallest things you can buy that's still can very easily save a life. So yeah, it's definitely, it's good that there's still people doing their best to get stuff to Ukraine. And no, we gotta keep awareness up. Jacoby, follow up. Go ahead.
Thank you. Have you? I'd be happy to share with you the people involved with getting some of these machines to Ukraine, if that would be helpful. Yeah, I'd encourage you to read that post. It's fairly interesting, and they are also, as I understand it, being used in some hospitals. I've spoken to people who are using them in. There's a complex of hospitals in Lviv that were using them, and they have peripheral attachments with them that are sometimes quite useful, and other times Ukrainian users and users have found workarounds for, you know, local workarounds that they've, you know, been able to craft, which leads me to my other question that, you know, when you are encountering equipment that is being provided by governments or yourselves, or, and not just equipment, but, you know, basic medical supplies, do you find that, you know, opportunities for equipment like this are worth, you know, the effort of training on? Or is it really what is truly needed are just everyday medical supplies of good quality, or a healthy mix of the two?
I think it's a really stupid answer, but it's just all of the above. You know, anything that can be used to save a life, you know, it will be used. You know, as you say, Ukrainians adapt things. They, you know, find better ways. They, you know, the company just started making their own tourniquets in Ukraine, a new company that's making them is a couple of existing ones. And, you know, they've bought 3D printers and done testing and, you know, developed it themselves. So, yeah, there's just a vast need for everything and anything. I don't know how to pinpoint it more than that. But, yeah, I think the key point is always making sure it finds, like you say, you know, a mobile life support system goes really well in a field hospital or a hospital. Not so much, you know, at the front lines. And it's about making sure that the equipment gets to people who can use it. Because I think everyone puts their hand, you know, mobile life support, you know, I'll have one of those. Thank you. Yeah, we need it, sure. But sometimes you've got to diligence the request to make sure that they know how to use it, that they can be trained on it, that, you know, they actually have a need for it. Yeah.
You know, when you have this equipment available to you, it is a question of getting the attachments to go with it and the peripherals to make, you know, if you have those available, then it makes the equipment, you know, very useful. If you have to scrape and beg for those attachments too, then it makes that piece of equipment not terribly worthwhile. So it's a real balance, I imagine.
Totally. You know, we deliver defibrillators. We're like, what are you going to do? You know, can you find the pads, you know, the replacement pads, you know, for the defibrillator after you've used them? And they're like, nope. Like, okay, we'll go find you some replacement pads and send them to you every few months. You know, sometimes you've got to assist with that, because, you know, the supply chain into Ukraine is pretty functional, but it's only just functional. So yeah, it's about all those consumable parts that you need to make the expensive bit of equipment work well.
Thank you, Jacoby. And next we have a question from Exit266, who I should mention. Ben is going to be interviewing Exit266, who is a researcher on the Black Sea shipping. And I assume maybe a few other topics will be discussed. That'll be Thursday at 1500 UTC. Exit, go ahead.
Thank you. James, I heard you talk about how your expectations and kind of the education on the situation has changed what you guys supply and how you supply it. Are you seeing a difference in the education level and the request type from people on the front line, and maybe even their abilities? I know that some of us are friends with folks who are working at training people on the front line. I'm just wondering if from your side, you've seen any change in that in the time that you've been in Ukraine.
The thing that I've noticed is they're more willing to say what they need now rather than, you know, there was this almost shyness about it in the early days. It's like, you'd say, what do you need? And they'd say, well, what can you give us? You know, it's like, well, no, but what do you need? Tell me. And now maybe it's just because we've got better relationships, or we're better at asking the question. You say, what do you need? And they tell us exactly what they need. You know, we need this amount of tourniquets, or we need this amount of Israeli bandages, or we need 6 new tires. You know, tires are one of the big things, since they get damaged by shrapnel really often. So yeah, I think the communication is getting better. You know, I think back in the early days, they were just shocked that foreigners were helping. And they're like, well, we don't want to offend them by, you know, telling them we don't need that or we need something else or whatever. So I think that's the thing that I've noticed most is they understand and can communicate what they need a lot better now. And I think also they're a lot more coordinated. You know, in the early days it was, you know, very disjointed. You know, even within, you know, you'd be talking to one person in a brigade or a battalion and the other person in the same medical, in the battalion, wouldn't know that you were talking to them. And now they're a lot more coordinated and communicating a lot better. And I think the lines of communication have gotten a lot better. So I think that, you know, as we evolve and we get better, they're, you know, they're doing the same. But I think that there was just, I had this view that, oh, they're military. They'll know exactly what they're doing day one. You know, I can just, you know, rely on that. And you know, a lot of them are new and, you know, being thrown into the city, even military people being thrown into a war, you know, it takes time to build the experiences as well. So, yeah, I think overall, you know, it's funny. It's like during winter, we worked with one brigade and they didn't have enough warm clothes. And, you know, a lot of people on Twitter have done this and done far more than us. But, you know, we knew these guys and we're like, okay, what do you need? And they said, oh, well, you know, warm clothes. I'm like, okay, how about we get you some, you know, thermal underwear? That's a good start. And then we said, how many do you need? And they're like, however many you can send. Well, what does that mean? And, you know, we had to keep pushing and pushing and pushing to get them to tell us. And then finally, the only way we could work it out was we said, okay, how many men do you have in the brigade? Okay, right, 3,500. Right, how many have you been given out of less than 500? Okay, so you need 3,000. Yes. Okay. And then, okay, we'll deliver you 3,000 thermals. So it's an unusual situation, but everyone's learning.
So, James, I have maybe one final question for you, and that, as we mentioned in the introduction, you wear a lot of hats in your life, basically a venture capitalist and investor at this point, and you're also an elected councilman in Australia. I'm curious, like, is there anything from this experience? I feel like it's maybe kind of a unique experience, right, compared to, like, the other stuff you do in your life. Is there anything you would take from this experience and, like, apply lessons or that you've learned that you would take back to the other hats you wear that kind of made you think about?
I think there's a couple of answers to that question. One is it's taught me to be a lot more organized, you know, like right down to really planning things and thinking, and also to understand a lot more, you know, consequences. I think that's, you know, in Ukraine, when you're traveling, you know, in a war zone, the consequences of something going wrong, you know, can be death, right? Can be death to the people that, you know, your volunteers and the people that you're bringing on the journey as well. So, you know, I think it's sort of helped me to be far more organized, think consequences through a lot more in my life. And then there's the human nature. People always say, oh, how's it changed you? And I can't really listen to fireworks anymore. Fireworks give me the chills. The sound is exactly the same as artillery for the big fireworks that go up. That's a side note. But the biggest thing that's changed me, and I think it's just, I don't sweat the small stuff. You know, I go back to Australia after being in Ukraine and seeing what the Ukrainians have to live with, and, you know, how in many ways upbeat they are. You know, in many ways they're not, but in they are upbeat, and, you know, they don't tend to complain too much about the situation here, and they deal with it. And you go back to Australia and someone will be complaining that their, you know, coffee's taking too long in a coffee shop, and, you know, how outrageous it is, been waiting too long for their coffee. And I just hear that now. You know, before I was probably the guy complaining about the coffee, but I hear it now and I just think, wow, you know, life's too short. So I think that's given me a fresh perspective on the importance of, you know, even things like family, friends, and, you know, you don't need to go to the fanciest restaurant. You know, the most important thing is to spend time with the people you love, because, you know, when you see how many people have lost people they love in Ukraine, really strengthens just how important that sort of stuff is. So, yeah, I think it's not, there's a lot that I take away. I don't think I really understand it yet, but you know, a lot that's made, you know, hopefully made me a better person.
Well, James, we certainly appreciate you taking the time to come talk to us. It's been great hearing about your experiences and your stories, and what you're doing for Ukraine is remarkable, and we really appreciate it. It seems like you have a really level head on your shoulders, and I mean, a lot of the people that are, I'll say, passionate enough or willing to go out and do this don't always exactly think 100% of everything through, but you seem like the type that always does. So it's good to know that there are people that are willing to go up there and also are willing to think about exactly the logistics of everything and all that. So thank you very much for stopping by, James.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. And thanks for everyone for the questions and the chat. It's been really cool. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome back anytime. Jonathan, back to you.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you, James, once again. Right, we are very privileged again to be joined by Charles, who is, alongside Andrew and others, are going to deliver our military segment for this week. Charles, over to you.
Yes, thank you very much, Jonathan. And that was a fascinating interview, especially talking about the adaptation and how this, how the needs and how supporters fulfill those needs has to change. Here we are. We are now 2 months into the Ukrainian offensive, primarily in the south along Zaporizhia front, but also, of course, around Bakhmut. And so this week, we're going to take a little bit of a look about where we are, what we've seen, and I'm going to use a metaphor or comparison today, a careful comparison, to talk about what can be coming up in the future, or what looks like is coming up in the future if we look at the patterns and trends, not only over the last couple of months, but basically over the last 8 months or so. So what have we seen? We saw the Ukrainian armed forces create two axes of advance, one of them towards Takhmak, the other one south from Velika Novosilka. There was a third one around Bakhmut, but the Western or the assault brigades, the Western trained and equipped brigades, were primarily allocated to the southern two axes. What happened at the beginning was what many observers, and me included and others expected, was a very Western-style tactic of tactical advance through using combined arms through defensive obstacles. This, we talked at length about breaching and vehicle maneuver. We talked about being able to walk the balance between concentration of forces and dispersion of forces in the face of overwhelming artillery power and observation through drones. And here we are 2 months in, and we have seen that the tactics have changed. That type of warfare, that method of approaching the Russian lines and trying to break through, had some limited success at the beginning, but at great cost to Western equipment, Ukrainian people, and also then, of course, what their combat power could be in the future. So now what we see is a change in tactics. They weren't provided with the equipment, were lacking the conditions to use those Western-style breaching and maneuver approaches that they had learned from Western allies, that had been talked about in most Western observers, including people in our military team and me. And so now we're looking at a different kind of offensive. Now, there are some successes from this Ukrainian offensive. Of course, most recently, we're hearing about Ukrainian entry of the town of Robotne, that being one of the strongholds in this line of defense that would be tactically significant. Additionally, they took Staromayorsky last week, and now it appears that the Russians have lost Eurozhiny across the river, whether that is a withdrawal or a withdrawal under pressure from Ukrainian forces. It's not exactly clear, but we are seeing successes along those two axes of advance, be it slowly. In Bakhmut, on the north and south sides of the town, Ukrainian forces, these are units that have been there for a very long time. For example, the 3rd Special Assault Brigade continue to fight and have success on the north and south sides of Bakhmut, although over the last week that has slowed somewhat, but that is a difficult position for the Russians to be in. Now, in all three of these areas, the reports are that the Russians have had to reallocate reinforcements. We heard that about 3 weeks ago north of Bakhmut, maybe a month ago north of Bakhmut, that the Russians had to allocate a lot of reserves to stop that advance, which was approaching a critical intersection, a critical area north of Bakhmut, which essentially would have cut off a large part of several kilometers of the Russian front line around Berkivka. Now, the ISW reports today, for example, that the Russians have brought in some elements of the 7th BDV to reinforce the southern axis, especially around Robotnik. this is definitely good news, but of course, as everybody is saying now, we have entered an attritional phase of this offensive after those initial breakthrough attempts were not successful or were lacking the equipment and the conditions necessary to be successful. And of course, when we talk about the attritional phase, we're talking about the attrition of combat power, so not just of personnel, but actually more importantly, about equipment and munitions. This is why the Ukrainian armed forces have been using their artillery, especially in a counter-battery approach, to attrit Russian artillery and as well as command and control and logistics centers. So the question comes up, will it stay like this? Is this what we have? Is this it? Is this the way the rest of the war is going to be? Is this the way the rest of the summer or the rest of the year is going to be? And my answer is no. And to justify that answer a bit, I'm going to draw an analogy, and I'm going to actually bring us back to the First World War. Now, no analogy is perfect, and in this one, I want to be very careful about why I choose this analogy, but I've chosen it for three different reasons. First of all, World War I is a good example of when the defense is stronger than the offense, and the offense does not have the capability to fully overcome defensive fortifications and defensive tactics with what they had. Second, we're looking at a contested and evolutionary airspace, with neither side using fixed-wing or rotary aircraft in terms of a classical air-on-air air superiority campaign. The air battle has become a drone battle. And the evolution that we see in drone warfare just in the last month is like a fast forward, in my opinion, is like a fast forward of the evolution of air warfare in World War I. And the third reason why I choose this is because this is the last time that we can look at a common history or a common understanding that's well documented of attritional warfare in practice, how it was conducted and how it worked. Of course, there are many other examples, but in the Western consciousness, this is probably the most well-known. One could argue that definitely campaigns of the Second World War also have this, but they are not in the living, or they're not in the common memory of most people in the West in that way. So that's why I think it's important, and that's why I'm going to draw some parallels here between what we've seen over the last basically 6 to 8 months, especially over the last two. I'm going to compare it a little bit with World War I, and we're going to draw that into some areas into the future. But of course, I want us to look at the First World War in the time at which they were living it. Not in hindsight, but let's go back to 1914, 15, 16, and what the people at the time were thinking and doing and how they reacted and how the evolution of the tactics in that war have certain parallels. So I'm going to cover a few topics today, and anybody can ask any questions during this. You can interrupt me. Anybody come up, no problem. But I've got basically four major points I want to hit. One is the tactical evolution of ground warfare, where that came from, where it is, and where it could be going. The second is on logistics and command. And the third one is on drones. And finally, we'll look at some more next steps. And also some news built in from this week, which will help reinforce this. So first of all, if we go back to 1914, there were several technological advances which caused the defense to be considerably more dangerous, or basically more powerful, than the offensive capabilities of armies at the time. Now, the commanders at the time did not know that, or very few of them did, until the war actually started. We go back in time to World War I, we look at smokeless powder, we look at the machine gun, we look at the use of barbed wire, and at the beginning there, the use of mines and so on. I equate that very similar today with the anti-tank guided missile and the anti-armor, the handheld, man-portable anti-armor weapons that basically make a concentration of force, in this case armored vehicles, a very vulnerable target. We saw that, of course, in the initial Russian invasion or full-scale invasion last year, but now we're seeing it again repeated as the war has entered a more stagnant phase. This includes the Russian winter offensive and includes the Ukrainian summer offensive. But this was one item that makes it so that the what was thought to be the ultimate offensive weapon in World War One time, they still believed that the cavalry charge was an offensive multiplier and combat effective, and that mass formations, volume of troops with the rifle and firepower were powerful enough. They learned very quickly that those things were not. And that also meant that even when offensives, even when attacks were able to gain ground, another thing that was clear early on in the First World War is it became very difficult for them to hold any kind of position. So what happened over the course of several years, and then especially in 1918, both sides had adopted raiding forces or shock troop type tactics with small units moving through the no man's land or the area without cover and concealment between the front lines to infiltrate those lines, to gain footholds, and to thus create small breakthroughs in a sort of bite and hold type maneuver. Breakthroughs, in this case, breakthrough maybe doesn't mean the same thing today, nor did it mean in 1918 what we may have thought about 2 years ago or 10 years ago if we're looking at Western doctrine. Coming out of the history of the Second World War or Operation Barbarossa or other things like that, we might think of a breakthrough being dozens or hundreds of kilometers even with fully mechanized forces. Back in World War One in 1918, when they started to create breakthroughs, first in Ludendorff Spring offensives by the Germans and then by the Allied forces later that year in their counterassaults, they were talking in very small increments being a breakthrough and more into a bite and hold type mentality. This is a tactic that we have seen evolve in Ukraine over the last 8 months. Now, primarily, if we can go back to the Battle of Bakhmut, when Wagner was started their main attacks in December of last year, one of the tactics that they switched to through the Bakhmut attacks and operations were these small unit shock troop raiding forces that would go in and bite and hold. We talked about this being part of Russian urban doctrine at the time, but it was also a tactic that was replicated in other attacks by the Russians in varying degrees of effect. What we could see is that the mechanized full breakthrough approach using concentrated mechanized forces was not working against the Ukrainian defenses, notably in Volodar. But in other areas where they had adopted more light infantry, not even light infantry, dismounted infantry in small unit tactics to infiltrate defenses to create small bite and hold breakthroughs, that worked. And that's what we're seeing now on the Ukrainian side around Rozhany and Robotny. We're not looking at these, what we saw 2 months ago with the large numbers of Bradleys and the Mikliks and the engineering equipment and so on. This is an evolution in the tactics. Of course, what happened next in the First World War was as the technology advanced to support and to overcome these different tactical disadvantages in defense. So, for example, soldier-carried light machine guns. We cannot forget the evolution of the tank, of course, was a huge support in 1918, late 1917 in the Allied attacks. So technology adapted to support these tactics in a way so that it didn't stay the same. Even though they evolved these shock troops and raiding and infiltration tactics, technology evolved to support them even greater, including, for example, the light machine gun, which enabled infantry to carry more firepower and to fit the needs that they had. We will continue to see tactical and technical innovation in this war to support these types of tactics. The second point, I'll stop there. Jonathan, please.
Thanks, Charles. This is really interesting. I mean, during the kind of the end of World War One, the 100 Days Offensive, the Second Battle of the Marne, there were kind of German attacks followed by these Allied counterattacks, which overwhelmed the German forces. They were supported at the time, like you pointed out, by overwhelming numbers of armored forces. I think I'm right in saying that Russia currently holds the numerical advantage in terms of armored forces and artillery. what is Ukraine's answer to this? How have they adapted in order to give this overwhelming force that we saw, that you used in your comparison? How has that overwhelming force of tanks used in the Second Battle of the Marne? What's the equivalence in Ukraine in 2023?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So for example, in this case of the Second Battle of the Marne, actually what I'm saying is that in 1918, both sides had developed tactics with shock and raiding troops first to infiltrate the enemy defenses. Even the use of the armored forces, the tanks and so on. And by the summer of 1918, we have to keep the context a little bit in context here, and I'll get to logistics here in a moment. But after the spring offensives, after the Ludendorff offensives by the Germans, they were very much exhausted from munitions, equipment, and so on, and they never had actually the armored force to counter it. But those attacks, by 1918, both armies were using at first. The first attack was by infantry in small groups infiltrating enemy positions, creating routes through the obstacle belts and so on, in this case, wire and other things, before a concentration of mechanized or infantry units would ever appear, would ever start their assault. This was something that's different. I think that it's a misconception that, you know, we see these images from the First World War where somebody blows the whistle and everybody goes over the top. Yes, that, of course, did exist, but those tactics evolved over time, and commanders, of course, learn. And this is why I'm saying that actually, even with the innovation of the tank and these kinds of things, these kinds of raiding forces and infiltration forces were the main tactical innovation. Now, will we see a situation, to keep with the metaphor, to keep with the analogy, will we see a situation such as the German army faced in the summer of 1918, where their forces had been attrited to such a level that it was impossible for them to hold any gains that they made in the spring in their hopeful knockout blow against the Allies before more Americans showed up in theater? We shall see. I mean, that's clearly what the Ukrainians are working towards with this attritional phase. And by focusing on combat power of artillery and logistics, is the intent to attrit the combat power of the frontline forces so that eventually more concentrated attacks, larger breakthroughs would then be possible. Now, will Russia be able to withstand this? Not sure. It is a good sign, of course, today that, you know, that reserves are being moved into the area to reinforce these two axes of advance. But one question I would have for the Ukrainian forces, of course, is do you plan to stay on these two main axes of advance? At this point, it is not a surprise at all what the next objectives are. I mean, I can look at a map and say Staromelinivka, would be the next major objective south of Velika Novoselka. I could say that Nove would be a next major objective south of Vorobyne. But on the attritional side, that's the question everybody is asking, is will we see that Russian combat power, and combat power, I mean logistics, command and control and all of this, will it be attrited enough so that greater maneuver that the Bradleys, the Martyrs, the Strikers, T-72s can actually break free into a larger breakout? I'm not sure if that answers your question, but maybe.
Yeah, I think it does, Charles. The adaptation that you spoke of is one which has certainly surprised Ukraine's enemy, and Ukraine has shown this continuous ability to adapt. Thank you.
Let's go to Imperius Guardsman.
Hi, thanks, Charles. Yeah, I actually wanted to sort of take a different tack to Jonathan's question there, right? Because part of the way he phrased it was sort of asking what's the equivalent to the advent of combined arms with tanks, right, to help break the trenches, you know, building on pure infantry raiding tactics. And I think if we want to get a little bit more abstract, we can sort of take it as a question of, you know, what key enablers does Ukraine actually need to make a breakthrough, right? Because there's the question of why, in fact, Ukraine would want to switch towards the more attritional positional fighting, right? Because a lot of the commentary around it has to do with the fact that they don't actually have the air assets to, you know, to enable a full combined arms movement on the operational level. So they to preserve men and lives, given, you know, they can't, like, the stool won't work with only two legs, right? So, like, in that sense, what we're seeing now is part of the adaptation, but, you know, it's not entirely necessary, I don't think, if the support was more forthcoming, or if, yeah, there was more material available.
Yeah, and I think that we would all agree with that. So I'm not actually proposing that the way that we see the ground force tactics by the Ukrainian armed forces is necessarily what they want to do. But as you mentioned, without the air support, that is sort of what they have to do. That is the most effective way. And that's why I go back to the First World War, where air superiority was a completely new thing. And maybe I'll just jump into drones for 1 second. In my opinion, the evolution of drones as we see it over the last year is very nearly parallel to the evolution of aircraft in the First World War. Started talking about observation first. These are your normal consumer drones with a camera. So there were certain higher capability ones, which Ukraine didn't really have. Russia hadn't really invested in. Then you start going into greater reconnaissance, of course, more mobility of that observation. You go into harassment bombing, basically what we've seen with the very, very simple dropping of grenades or even the kamikaze drones. Now we're starting to see that drones are starting to develop specific functionalities within a group. So you're starting to see hunter-killer teams of drones, swarms of drones. I fully expect that we will see more air-to-air and more squad-level air-to-ground anti-drone capabilities evolving, just as we did in the First World War when the evolution of the airplane, I mean, development cycles were numbering in months for airplanes back then. Now I think we're looking at, you know, the drone videos that we see today, you know, those drones and the tactics that they use, I think will already be obsolete within 2 months' time. That's the pace of the innovation there. But I would say that on the ground side, I think that we're looking at a new definition of combined arms warfare. In the case of, you know, what does combined arms look like without fixed wing aircraft, with all of that stuff that the Russians and that the Americans and that NATO have invested in. Now we're looking at what is combined arms with a different type of air assets, and that being the evolution of drones. But let me go to Andrew.
Yeah, so I have just a slightly different point, which we'll lean back into what I think you want to get into anyway. But Ukraine has kind of two major problems going on right now. And the first is they just don't have enough artillery ammunition to support the sort of combat that they're doing. This is why they were really hoping for a breakthrough where they could do this mobile war, because they didn't have ammo to do this prolonged grinding attritional phase. And second, they also kind of don't have the infantry to do this either. They don't have enough manpower to grind out for however long it's going to take to bust through all these layers of defenses. So there has to be some other technology to break through that isn't artillery and isn't charging. So there has to be something else. And the Russian defenses right now are so well constructed, and they're getting old
They've been built for a long period of time now, and that means plants are growing around the defenses, like, you know, grass and bushes, all these things are growing, and it's becoming incredibly camouflaged. You know, the grasses are growing taller, although some of them are burning away, and I'm loving it. But you know what I mean? Like, these defenses are kind of being swallowed by nature, and that's going to make attacking them even harder. So there has to be some weapon to nullify these defenses. And to me, the logical weapon is a bomb. But the problem is, Ukraine doesn't really have much of an air force. So how can you deliver bombs to these defenses without really using an airplane? Well, there's one way. There's like something like a JDAM, where you can drop bombs from very far away. But the problem there is electronic warfare is one issue. And second, you just don't have enough planes to drop enough bombs. So there has to be another way to deliver these bombs. And the only thing I can think of is a drone.
Yeah, I think... I actually agree with you in the last point, which is that there will have to be something. And this is where, you know, when I'm just kind of fast forwarding to the next steps here, but the first line of Russian defenses that are being taken now, basically, in Robotne, and which they are approaching along the Veliky Novosilka axis, and I think, you know, we could debate whether this is the first, second, third line or whatever. But I do not expect that the way that these have been taken and with the technology that they have taken these is necessarily going to be the same that they are going to take the second, the third, or the fourth. So that the tactics will change and the technology will change. I think, for example, General McRyan in his blog called for a quote-unquote Manhattan project for countermine operations, because that is in this type of warfare, in this type of combined arms warfare, that is a huge threat that is hampering maneuver. If I think back to World War One and the technologies that they developed, I don't know exactly what will develop out of this. But take, for example, the increased use of man-carried mortars in the First World War. This was a technology that was developed. It was actually predated the First World War, but it was implemented in wider scale use exactly because of trench warfare. So maybe we look at something that where we have much, much smarter mortars. Maybe we look at something where we have net-like Miklicks. Instead of a line, we have a net that goes out. Maybe we look at something from with drone technology, with ground drone technology, which is able to do certain things in this environment that soldiers might have to do now. So I don't know exactly where it's going to go, but if I'm looking at the evolution of technology and tactics so far in this war, I think that if we're having this discussion in December, we're going to look back in this and say, wow, I had no idea that this technology would exist and be on the battlefield in large scale numbers. And the question is, you know, which side is better? The first question is which side is better able to do that? I think that Ukraine, with the support of Western technology, as long as it is dedicated and funded for this, will greatly outpace Russian capability to adapt. The Russians, their adaptations so far have not been particularly technological. They have done some technical things, their tactical things, but their technological innovations so far, at least when I'm looking at it, are coming from basically external purchases. So the Shahed drone, for example, was a technology that they purchased, which had a significant effect. And so I think that we will be looking at considerable number of not just drone, but also ground warfare, technological and thus tactical innovations. So when I look at support from the Western allies now, I don't see a whole lot of things in the existing stock that is really all that helpful. Even ATACMS, for example, or Taurus. It would be fantastic that they have both of these, but are they considerably going to change things? No. Will the F-16? Potentially. But the real ongoing political support, financial support, and technological support is what is going to come in the next 3 months or 6 months, which we have never seen before. I think that we're at that point. Naturally, things like Bradleys, Challengers, Martyrs, these still have a purpose and they need to be provided in much greater numbers. But I think the real difference maker we haven't seen yet. And that's why it kind of comes to my last point, which is attacks on logistics and command. You know, this was something as the First World War became attritional. Often I think that we think about attritional warfare simply in the context of, again, men going over the top and being slaughtered by machine guns. But looking at it from a higher level, the attritional warfare actually existed on multiple levels, and the attrition was against the Central Powers' ability to continue to make war. And that was on a morale side, that was on a technology side, that was an economic side, and that was on their ability to deliver that war-making capacity to the actual front. Now, of course, in the First World War, there didn't exist anything like Storm Shadow or Taurus or any of that. But they knew what they were doing in terms of trying to stop the Central Powers from being able to make war. And this is where I think, looking at it now, if I were to say one other thing that needs to be done, the Ukrainian armed forces within 60 or 100 kilometers of the front lines is doing absolutely everything they can to enact that attrition on Russia's ability to deliver its war-making capability to the front. But this is where they need to rely on Western powers to fill the gap beyond that 100 kilometers, so to say. This is why I'm looking forward to listening to Exit talk about the Black Sea. This is why I'm looking at Ben to talk about the ruble and other type of potential for secondary sanctions or whatever it may be. Because I think that to accelerate this tactical shift by the Ukrainian armed forces, doing what they can with what they have, and the operational approach that they've chosen, it would all be accelerated if they were to receive more strategic support to really cut down the Russia's ability to make war from a manpower, material, equipment, technology, and so on. Again, because I think at this point, if I'm looking at what has been effective tactically on the battlefield, the game changers are not yet there. We don't see them yet. And it is a bit of a race at this point for Ukraine and its Western allies to get those game changers to the point of contact as quickly as possible. John?
Thank you, Charles. Just to piggyback off this just a little bit, the way that I've been thinking about this problem set is that there are obviously solutions that are not known to us currently that the Ukrainians will likely need to innovate for themselves, although we can attempt to assist them in that effort, as you've pointed out. But from my perspective, a large part of the problem seems to be is that the magnitude of the innovative new solutions that are required to address the challenges that they face at the front is being, shall we say, unnecessarily exacerbated by the fact that we have not, in many respects, done a fantastic or not nearly as sufficiently rapid alignment of Ukrainian capabilities with the capabilities and assets that both the defense industrial base of the United States, as well as Ukraine's other allies and partners, can sustain more or less indefinitely in the medium to long term. So, for example, take the F-16s. You know, they, and along with many of these other assets that, you know, Ukraine has requested but has yet to receive or has only received in fairly limited quantities, none of them will be a decisive game changer, so to speak, as you said. But they represent incremental, sustained progress that will lessen Ukraine's need to evolve these more decisive solutions. They will create more trade space for flexibility. And what is significant is that, again, just to use the specific example of the F-16s, that is a solution that we can sustainably support in the medium to long run, along with the munitions and other, you know, assets such as targeting pods that they can employ. Those are all things that we can sustainably support for years to come. Some of these other items, dramatically less so.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, I mean, just to come back to the First World War quickly, is that, you know, when that war started, none of the armies thought that they would need the munitions that they needed, right? So they were in a race for production of the basics as well. They were in a race to produce basic soldier equipment. Of course, they had mobilized millions. They were expending way more munition than they thought. The war was going on a lot longer than they thought. Casualties were much higher than they thought. And so as you go into, you know, late 1914 and early 1915, you know, of course, it's a race to ramp up. So I think that, you know, if we talk about munitions, for example, John, it is critical, and we may have already passed this point. I don't know. You know better than I whether, you know, for example, this European peace facility where the investments in U.S. munition production, I mean, has the delay been so long that we're already behind? Or because I'm just looking at it comparatively, but that the basics need to be ramped up. An example of what I'm thinking about in terms of new technology is, you know, there was an announcement today that Rheinmetall will be delivering the Luna drones, something from the Luna platform. We don't know exactly which one, to Ukraine by the end of the year. Now, these are what we would consider at this point kind of classic but highly advanced reconnaissance drones. Germany doesn't make weapons delivery drones, but these are reconnaissance drones. The question that I have is, I think this technology is already obsolete, but that doesn't necessarily make it worthless. This is a great thing to provide with Ukraine, but Rheinmetall and Ukraine need to already be looking at the next step, which I'm sure they already are. The question is when will we see it? Did I respond a bit, John?
Yeah, I think so. My broader concern, I guess, to be a little bit more specific, you know, is beyond simply, you know, scaling our capacity to meet basic needs such as shells or other basic forms of ammunition. It's that we have capacity to provide certain assets and capabilities. However, the way that Ukraine is currently approaching the battle space doesn't really make use of those assets or capabilities either at all or to a particularly large extent. And to give an example of this, really, our bread and butter in terms of industrial capacity is air-to-surface munitions, things for aircraft, bombs, you know, precision-guided munitions or air-launched precision-guided munitions of various descriptions. And to give a more specific example, we are currently sitting on, I believe, Boeing has capacity to produce 9,000 small-diameter bombs per year. Their orders currently for both the U.S. Air Force and SNS foreign military sale customers is currently less than 1,000 on order. So 8,000 units of that 9,000 unit capacity is sitting essentially unused. That is something that we could sustain, you know, more or less a Gimler's-esque capability that we could sustain effectively and indefinitely because we have the existing production line at scale. And it's something that Boeing can increase if there is, you know, customer demand to do so. And there's things like SLAM ER in terms of once you start getting into the kind of the longer range setting, there's an existing production line for that that can be scaled, but Ukraine can't currently make use of that because they don't have the appropriate platforms to employ it, which is, again, fixed-wing assets such as F-16s. And that's really what I mean by aligning these capabilities in that we are trying to ramp production again of those basics of those shells because that is not something that we had existing capacity to sustain their expenditure of. But we do have these other items that we can sustain the expenditure of, but their force is not currently structured or equipped to make use of them.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, this is where if I'm looking at an investment or an innovation, you know, it sounds to me like what we need is we need a $15,000 drone that can carry a JDAM, and we need it to be able to work in swarms and hunter killer with reconnaissance drones on a very cheap basis. So, for example, what is the lowest entry technology that is developable? That's not even a word, but which can be developed to utilize our strengths, and that's kind of what I'm that's just an example, but that's why I think things are going to be going. If I compare to, you know, this example, I'm just using the First World War as an example, but I think it would be a mistake for any observer of this war to think, okay, well, this is the way it is. This is the way it is going to be for the rest of the summer, the rest of the year, or so on. But that's kind of what I'm thinking in terms of innovation. John?
You're exactly right, Charles. But I guess the unfortunate aspect of it is that, you know, once we have those solutions, it's still going to take time to implement at scale. I think GLSDB, ground launch small diameter bomb, is a good example of this. It was something that was already, fortunately, already mostly through the development pipeline, but something which was fairly quickly rushed to completion in terms of research and development once the invasion began. But despite the fact that it is a functional weapon system that has, you know, been tested, validated, that does function, we have spent the past 8 months trying to create capacity for it, you know, despite the fact it already leverages, you know, existing materials and technologies.
Yeah, thank you. We need to wrap up because we've got one more segment today, but maybe I just have one more question just to follow up on that, John, before we close up. But, you know, there was this request from the administration for $24 billion in supplemental funding for Ukraine. I think the total thing was much higher than that, but that was the portion that was somehow looked like it could go to Ukraine, but it was very vague. Was there anything in that? Is there anything when you've read about this request that actually goes to improving production or innovation versus, you know, just providing more of the same?
So in terms of the specific language of the request, or at least the documentation that has been released to the public, Colby has a better handle on that because he actually read through the text itself. My understanding is that it isn't really clear. The wording is just very confusing and not at all straightforward. It's kind of, you know, typical, I shouldn't say legalese. It's, you know, typical appropriation speak. The bullet point summary that was released to journalists wasn't super clear either. Of the $24 billion, $13 billion was allocated to the Department of Defense for security assistance, a combination of direct assistance to Ukraine, as well as continued backfilling of U.S. and partner inventory. The breakdown wasn't super specific at this point. In terms of scaling capacity, I think that that's been included in other supplemental appropriations packages previously, because the increase from 14,000 rounds a month to, I believe, 45,000, that was already planned before the invasion began. We simply stepped up the timeline for that and changed the desired end state from 45 to 90,000 rounds. But I believe the funding for that was at least mostly previously in prior appropriations packages.
Thank you, John. Colby, did you want to add something?
Yeah, thanks. I wrote a short thread about the budget request. I just put it up in the Nest. In short, there's $5 billion for Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which is the money that the United States uses to buy capabilities from industry which do not yet exist. So the ground launch small diameter bomb that John referenced, that's a capability that's being procured through USAI. So there's another $5 billion worth of money for that. There is $4.5 billion, which is for replenishing DoD stocks and increasing production of munitions, which are needed for both Ukraine and the United States. The concerning thing for me is that there is only $1.1 billion in presidential drawdown authority being authorized in this, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because that's the main method by which Ukraine is receiving the needed capabilities on an ongoing basis that are coming out of U.S. stocks. So most of the artillery ammunition, all of the artillery guns, the HIMARS, the GMLRS, all of that is mostly coming out of drawdown stocks. And within this budget request for the next fiscal year, only $1.1 billion can be provided. So I'm not exactly sure what's
going on with that, why that number is so low. Typically, it's been much higher in the previous budget requests. So this is something that we very urgently need the journalists to ask the administration to explain what's going on in the supplemental, because the information that's been provided here is not nearly as clear as some of the previous ones have been in my view. So there's a lot of uncertainty and answers that are needed.
Okay. Thank you very much, Colby. Yeah, hopefully they'll have a press conference on Monday or something to see. I want to thank you guys for joining the conversation. We'd have been over time. I'm not sure if we have the next segment or if we need to end, but just to sum up, you know, I use the comparison with World War One very lightly in the case of I do not want to give an impression that this is, you know, a stalemate that is going to last for many, many years. In fact, if anything, I see that the innovation cycles and tactics and technology are much quicker. But I looked back at it for some of the similarities, specifically a case where it's easily researched in terms of a case where the defense has been much stronger than the offense, how tactics evolved over that time, how logistics production evolved over that time, how the armies treated it. Also, a contested and evolutionary airspace with a completely novel technology, unknown capabilities. How is it used? What can we do with it? How that evolves over the next several months. And also that just because it is the way it is right now, I do not think this is the way that it will always be. Things will change, and we shall see that sooner rather than later. So thank you very much for the time. Jonathan, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you to the fantastic panel speakers we have up here. Thank you to everyone for tuning into Totally again this week. Please check out our popular and extensive series of podcasts on Spotify if you are just listening in for the first time. We recommend tuning into the broadcast from Mr. Bond, which analyzes open source intelligence from Ukraine. That's at the top of this hour. Please do tune in tomorrow for a very special, unique interview at 1700 Kyiv, 1500 UTC, 0900 Eastern Time, for an interview with the CEO of the Halo Trust. Ukraine, as we know, has been mined by Russia across huge swathes of its land. This is a challenge which Ukrainians will face for many years to come. The Halo Trust is one of the world's leading organizations that can help demine Ukraine in its non-combat areas the most. If you have any questions about the scale or the scope facing Halo's deminers, or anything related to the work that they do, please consider tuning in. If you're understandably at work when this fascinating interview is happening, well, of course, you could tune in on our podcast platforms to find out the answers to your questions. We will, of course, be back again next time, next week, as Ukraine continues to endure. It endures for those who grow old as the war continues, for those who shall no longer grow old, and for those whose work, voices, and legacy forever endures. Slava Ukraini.
Heroi slava.
On behalf of the brave.